What we need to do is realize that God sees the whole picture. And for us to see the whole picture as God sees it, we need to draw close to God and learn from the lessons we go through. And the lessons that you go through and the trials you experience are not the ones that you have thought of in your mind, that you kind of have a pre-planned battle document ready to fight it, if I could put it that way. See? Because you can say in your mind, well, if this trial comes, well, I'm prepared for this trial. That's not the one you're going to get. Okay? Now, when we left Worldwide, we started Biblical. And that lasted 3 years. And the Constitution and bylaws that we developed with that one was almost, when I saw United, I looked at United's and it was deja vu. Committee here, committee there, committee everywhere. And what I had to learn. And this is how I learned that God doesn't want a hierarchy. What I had to learn was that committees with carnal men only create multiple political power bases. See? And so, that got so bad and hateful that we had to leave. And our exit from Worldwide was very pleasant compared to the exit from Biblical, which was hateful and mean and nasty. And to have someone you consider a close friend turn on you, you know, like that Psalm 28 in the hymnal, was not a foe that did deride, but a friend and my guide. When his words were smoother than butter, see, and his knife slipped in under the fifth rib. And it was a very disillusioning time. 49, four kids, no income, no vacation, no severance, no nothing. And I won't fill you in all the details, but we started out a couple weeks later, and I didn't know what to do or where to go. And Esther Greisinger called me. You probably heard me mention this on a tape before. And she said, you know, she called and I didn't want to talk to her. And I don't want to talk to anybody. Bam. And when I mean and nasty, I mean and nasty. So, and I was mean and nasty, but she was patient and persistent. So she called back and said, don't hang up. Don't hang up. Please don't hang up. So I said, okay. So she said, there will be seven of us up here. We'd like to have you come up on Sabbath and bring us a Bible study. And so that's how Christian Biblical got started. Biblical Church of God did not have very much Christianity in it. See? And the first lesson I learned was, you don't run down the road and say, this is the work of God. This is the work of God. And since it's the work of God, by the way, God, you better bless it, because I say it's the work of God. It took me a long time to really understand what God was doing, though I knew he was doing something. What it was, I didn't know. And I got so low, but I remember just kind of driving around out north of Hollister, out in the country, and here's this little hill. And so I just got out of the car and just walked, climbed up to the top of the hill and just got on my knees and just asked God, heal my soul. You know, because you're so wounded to everything that takes place, you just don't feel as though you have any soul or heart left, you see. And that's all I could say. You know, tears streaming down and so forth. And God heard and answered that prayer. And it was sometime later I began to understand about a hierarchy. But it wasn't until God put us through that trial. It was difficult on me, on my wife, on my children, and they suffer as well. But you see, through that, then, I've learned that you don't need a hierarchy What you need is love and cooperation and structure to what you need for the physical needs, and do what you need to do. And then you can have peace and cooperation because you're all loving each other and loving God. That way you're not striving as to who's in charge. If someone comes up with a good idea of doing things, why do it? You know? If someone has a question or something where they understand some truth in the Bible and bring it out, if it's truth, it's truth, correct, is it not? Yes. As I said through the years, fully 50% of my sermons have come from questions that the brethren have had. And we stayed at that 7 for a long time. And that's when I first began to sit down and teach. Because wouldn't it be stupid to stand up in a pulpit and browbeat 7 people? Now listen here, brethren, you know. And that's, and we discuss things quite often. And that's when we decided, well, regardless of what happens, we're just going to keep our noses in the Bible and study the Word of God and let God do the calling and let God do the adding. So we had 7 in the congregation and 3 on the mailing list, and that was it. See? And I learned to do real estate loans. So I had a job that I hated, being a loan broker, which I had to do, and I made pretty good money at it, and became quite proficient in it, by the way. I ended up learning so much that I always had to tell the title company how to run their business, and that got me irritated as can be, but nevertheless. And then my other job was being a minister, which the world hates. So when someone asked me, well, what do you do? I says, well, I have 2 occupations that are despised. One's a loan broker, one's a minister, you know. Hello, are we at cross purposes? But at 49 and with 4 kids, that's the only thing I could learn where I could make decent enough money. I started out as a loan officer, and from November until August, I earned $1,400. Then I got my California CFL broker license, which is consumer finance lender license. From August to December, I made $14,000, see. And there were times when I grossed, $110,000, something like that. So, but it was all commission. I didn't get a thing till I closed a loan. So it really, really became quite challenging. I'd have to get out and drive around, leave my rate sheets and, you know, talk to real estate people. They didn't always tell a new loan person walking in. Got his rate sheet in hand. Hello! It's almost like a big sign. New loan broker in town. And all the real estate agents, and they are snitty people indeed. They throw you the worst crumbs to try and get a loan with defunct credit and defunct property. And so actually, I specialized in that. And I made some pretty good money at it. And then I got in contact with a private investor in town, just by happenstance. Browder was his name. I didn't know him, but he's a big mucky-muck in town. But he keeps a pretty low profile because he builds and sells houses. And he had some money that he wanted to loan out and earn more than he could by just making a loan to someone without security or having to take a second. So then I began to specialize in construction loans, which are short-term loans. And so he would fund the money. We would put it into a trust account. They would earn interest on the trust account, and then we would draw down according to the construction schedule upon phased completion. So he would earn a point, and I would earn a point, and I would get some fees, plus the inspection fees, and then I would earn a point on the rollover to the final loan. So this worked real well. He made lots of money. I made lots of money. I suppose we funded pretty close to $10 million worth of loans on a rollover basis, you know. We fund one, close it out with a permanent loan, fund another one, and so that worked quite well. But my heart was really never in it, though I could do it well. And I had to learn. That's where God then began teaching me a lot of things, because I was not around anybody except our little congregation. And when I was driving, and I would drive, I would put on 60,000 miles a year just driving, you know, taking care of business and going to church and all that sort of thing. And my mind would always be on the scriptures. And I remember one day driving down the road where I just felt real muddled. You ever felt real muddled? Yeah, you're all smiling. You've all felt real muddled. And I remember just crying out to God, saying, "Oh, God, I'm so stupid. I really got zonked in on this thing with biblical, and I let people take me down the garden path, and I don't know how to think. Please help me to think. Help me to understand. And God has helped me a great deal." But you see, all the things that we went through in that has been not only a benefit to us, but a benefit to the people of God. See? And of course, in that condition, how many people would follow us? Not very many. So we got our noses in the Bible. And so instead of every year getting up and repeating the same thing, you know, like in Worldwide, I have my stack of sermon notes that I go through every 4 years. Okay. We decided just to get our noses in the Bible and go through verse by verse and word by word. Not have any set schedule. We'll just stick with it till we're done. First thing we did was a series in Romans, which we lost the originals for it. But nevertheless, we did a better series in Romans after we got the translation done. Then we did the whole Gospel of John verse by verse. And it took us 2.5 years to do that. We had 26 tapes in the major part of it. And then 26 tapes in the sub-series. And that's where we have the series on grace, sanctification, holiness, and so forth. We don't send out the series on John because it is, with the whole thing, it's quite lengthy. And it was during the series of John. Here, let's go to the book of John. During the series in John. Okay. Let's just use an example here, if I can find one. Okay. Let's come to John 5, verse 24. Well, at that time I was studying the Greek, and what I would do, every night when I would get home, I would study the Greek. Study, study, study. Dr. Dorothy said, study, study, study. Memorize, 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 memorize. Study, 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 study. Memorize, 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 memorize. And Greek is very difficult. And if I hadn't had German before, it would have been much harder for me to learn. But I had the equivalent of 2 years of Dr. Dorothy tutoring, and then I was on my own. So I would come home and I would study the Greek, study the Greek, study the Greek. And when we would go through the book of John, okay, let's pick it up here in verse 24, John 5. Let me explain to you. Verily, verily, and all through the book of John, I would remind everyone that means truly, truly. I say unto you, he that heareth my words and believeth on me, you see, the ETH is a present tense participle in the Greek, see? And I would always say that. This means the one who is hearing my word and who is believing on him that sent me has everlasting life. And so by the time we got done with the series on John, I was very tired of telling people the Greek says this, the Greek says that, and so were the brethren. And you know, that's how ministers hold the intellectual edge over people, by making it sound very complicated. See, well, I know the Greek, and all of you are a bunch of stupid lay people. So we decided, I said, how would you like to do a study going through the seven general epistles. Okay? And instead of going through telling you what the Greek says, I'll translate it. So that was my first attempt at translating James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. Now we've got the seven general epistles book, and we have 79 tapes to go with it. One series at a time, please. See. So as we got done with that, the different one said, well, I said, how would you like to study Romans when we get done with this? Fine. So then I began translating in earnest in the book of Romans. And so that's how the translation started out. It started out just to make it simple and easy for the brethren to understand. That's all. I haven't set myself up to say, Fred, are you not important? Thou art a Greekist scholar. See? What some people have accused me of. And some people accuse me that I am the only one that knows anything that's in the Bible. No, God is the only one that knows everything that's in the Bible. What we know, and there's a whole lot more for us to learn. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going to stand still for false doctrine. Now, if it's real damaging, like what John Reitenbaugh did with Pentecost, I name the person. And some sensitive politicians say, oh, you shouldn't name the person. Well, I did the tape. I sent the booklet and the tape with a letter to John Reitenbaugh. And I said, John, I love you, I care for you, but in this you're just completely wrong. And that I'm sending this to you in time so you can recover before Pentecost comes. And I sent it also to John Reed, one of his close associates. So anyway, that's how I got started translating the New Testament. Then I thought, well, I will do the rest of the epistles of Paul. And then we were running low on the harmony of the gospel. So I said, well, we need a precise translation for the next edition of the harmony rather than a paraphrase. So lo and behold, we're pretty close to doing the whole New Testament. So I said, okay, why not do the whole New Testament? Not that I think that I'm a greater scholar above anybody else and can know more than they do. But all of these New Age Bible versions are just leading people astray. So that's how it came about. So we have the harmony almost done, and we'll be full-time on finishing the New Testament. And in the meantime, through it, God has blessed us all with a lot of understanding. See? And there's still so much there for us to learn. See? So anyway, that's the long and short of where we are today. So now that you heard me rattle on, let's take some of your questions. The comment is, what are some of the things that I got myself in trouble with Pasadena, okay? And why I was marked as such a miserable, mean person, okay? It goes back quite a long ways. And it wasn't that I was rebellious. It was that I thought that the truth was over everybody, see? Well, is it or is it not? Is that a right thought or a wrong thought? It's a right thought. Okay. So when I came to Ambassador College, I knew that I was going to be a minister in my own heart, though they said, don't you dare think that you're going to be a minister. I said, okay, well, if God doesn't want me to be, I won't be. But nevertheless, if God does, then I will be. And so I approached everything at Ambassador College when I went. I went 61. I graduated in 64. I went 3 years because I had 3.5 years college before. And I applied myself to the scriptures and studied the scriptures. And I did something which I very rarely even mentioned because lest someone think I'm bragging or whatever, but I'm not. I'm just going to state a fact. Herbert Armstrong said he studied the Bible on his knees, so I thought that if I'm going to learn the Bible, I better study the Bible on my knees. And where we were, they had these prayer booths. And when we were going to college, the prayer booths were used all the time. All the students were praying. When I went back there in 72, they were all stuffed as storage bins. But nevertheless, I found a prayer booth down here. How many have been to Del Mar? Downstairs, you come downstairs, and to the left, there's some prayer booths, and to the right, there's the furnace, and straight ahead is the fellowship room. You all go down there and fellowship in the refrigerator, and you have your cheese and pickles and stuff in there, you know. So to the right, there was the furnace and three prayer booths. Well, the third prayer booth over here, just up over on the wall, was an outlet. So I got an extension cord, and I took my little tabletop desk lamp, which is the crook neck with single bulb, and I plugged it in, and I took it into the prayer booth with me, and I studied. That's where I studied. And I did what they said at the time was that your personal Bible study has nothing to do with your classes. That's separate. See? And I was never political. Never political. Still not to this day. Never will be. Thank you, God. Anyway. So, I did well in class. No one, in my second year there, they didn't quite know what to do with me, job-wise, because I had studied German and I was quite proficient in German at that time, so they thought maybe they could put me into German work. But then Frank Schnee was there and whoever else was there, so that took care of that. So they didn't know what to do with me. And for work, they put me up in letter reading. So up in letter reading, and I would always, someone write in for the first time, I make sure they get, why were you born? And some other basic booklets to help them. And be studying. Meanwhile, we took all the classes. We took, you know, the speech class, the Bible class, you know, Dr. Hayes' history class. And the only way you learn in Dr. Hayes' history class is sit up in the front row and look them right in the eyes so you can be alert and stay awake. Because if you sit in the back, all the dum-dums sit in the back and he knows it and they get straight D's. So anyway. Yeah, Carl and I always used to sit up in the front and in Dr. Hayes' world history class, I made this big long chart, you know, going through compendium one, compendium two, and all of that. And the students at that time were dedicated, and they were praying, and they were studying. There was a whole different spirit there until Mrs. Armstrong died in 1967. Okay? Well, anyway, it came senior year, and lo and behold, when they called out the assignments for ministerial sentence, my name came up. And everyone was shocked when my name came up, Fred Coulter to Eugene to assist Dale Hampton. See, because it wasn't political. No one knew too much about me except the different teachers and so forth. So I went out there and I assisted Dale Hampton the best I could. And he had a very unfortunate situation. He had a son that was a complete paraplegic. Nothing but just a bag of bones. Ricky was his name. Couldn't get out of, you know, had to be diapered, had to be fed. Very sad, very tragic. And the assistants would mow the lawn and do all the errands and things like this. So I did all of that. And I was very happy to do it. But I remember one real moment I had was when I was helping Dale Hampton. We were getting ready for the feast. And they couldn't take Ricky to the feast, so they always left him with a woman who would watch over him. And I remember that I had to pick him up and carry him out to the car. And that was really quite an experience. You know, and so Dale Hampton really had a burden with that. And unfortunately, he became just a complete alcoholic over it. Very sad. But anyway, I hope this begins to answer the question. But when they decided, I'll tell you another little side story here. When they decided that I could go out and visit on my own, they sent me out with Otis Cole, one of the sweetest men in the world. And we would talk. He's a very, what you might say, shy and unassuming man. And we became very close friends. And he did almost all the talking once he got warmed up. So he told me about the old days at the school in Jefferson School, where Mr. Armstrong started. And he told me something else that really flabbergasted me. He said that he was in the Church of God Seventh Day, born into it. His father was an elder in the Church of God Seventh Day. And that in 1917, his father, now listen to this, brought to Duggar and Dodd the truth of Israel and the holy days. 10 years before Herbert Armstrong ever found out about the Church of God. And I also found out that Mrs. Rencorn was a member of the Church of God Seventh Day. See, so there's a little fudging in the autobiography as you go along. See. But nevertheless, so when Herbert Armstrong in 1931 brought up about Israel and the holy days, guess what? Duggar and Dodd had already been through it. See? And I remember when I was up in Boise. Well, we'll have to back up here. Okay. Then, in 1965, January, Dolores and I got married. Came back up and lived in Eugene. And then in April, for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at that time we still had the whole region, the district thing where everyone would come into Portland. And Herbert Armstrong came in, stayed the whole week. He and his wife Loma, we had services every day. And they scheduled me to bring a sermonette. And so I brought a sermonette on 1 Chronicles 28, serve God with a willing heart and keep his commandments. That's what David told Solomon. And my wife, who is a close friend of Loma, was sitting right there with Loma, and Herbert was right there, and she goes like this, Dolores told me, like that to Herbert, and says, "You better ordain that man." See, well, I guess they already had plans to ordain me because the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread in 1965, which then is, today is that anniversary of that. Never thought of it until just now. I was ordained by Herbert W. Armstrong, personally, see. And I never really had any problems with Herbert W. Armstrong. Well, what they did, they sent me on over to Boise to pastor in Boise. And so Dolores and I, when we got married, we packed up everything in our Fury 3 Plymouth 4-door. We had the trunk full and the back seat full. Well, when we packed up to go to Boise, we filled up the back seat, the trunk, and a U-Haul trailer. So we went on over to Boise, and we relieved Fred Kellers over there, and Fred Kellers have never liked me to this day because I took over where he thought he should have stayed. And I was ordained before him because he graduated the year before me. So here's all this political stuff going on, see, and I'm not even aware of it. So we get over to Boise, and everything is going along fine. And lo and behold, one day, here's a man that shows up in services, never saw before. So I go over and introduce myself, and he introduces himself as Ray Benight, minister of Church of God Seventh Day. Interesting. This is the one that Herbert Armstrong knew personally. Okay. So he said, "Well, why don't you come by and visit me?" He says, "I live in Napa." I said, "Be happy to." So I came by to visit him one day, around some visiting. We're sitting there talking, and then he starts against Herbert Armstrong. Tells me how vain he was and how everything he was, and so forth, and so when he got done, I just said, "Well," I said, "Mr. Benight," I said, "isn't it a shame that God had to use Herbert Armstrong to preach the truth about Israel in the holy days because no one in the Church of God Seventh Day would?" Of course, I got up and left. Okay. Well, when we went down to visit in Pasadena, Dolores told Loma about it. So Loma called Herbert, and here I'm around the campus taking pictures because they just got the auditorium done, and they were redoing some things, and I wanted to take them back and show the slides to the brethren. Okay. So here one of the guards come up to me and says, "You're wanted up in Herbert Armstrong's office right now." What have I done? That's when his office was up over the old library. So I get in the elevator, go up, see him, and he welcomes me with open arms, and he wanted me to tell him everything about Ray Benite and the other Church of God Seventh-day ministers that I had run across. We sat there and talked for over 2 hours. And it was a wonderful conversation, very delightful. See? I never had anything against Herbert Armstrong. It was later what Stan Rader coerced him into doing. So lo and behold, I get down there, and boy, David John Hill lights into me a couple hours later and says, "What are you doing up in Herbert Armstrong's office? Are you trying to gain something?" See, and that's how the hierarchy always viewed me, see? I said, "Hey, I was invited up. What am I going to do?" See. Okay. Our first child was a girl, born too much premature, and died at 9 months in our own arms. So we know what it's like to lose a child. So they decided that it would be best for us to move out of the Boise area and go down to Salt Lake, and hook Salt Lake up with Boise, and I would fly every week. Well, being in that remote geographical area, I had to run everything on my own. Carlton Smith was the district superintendent, and he would come over when I first went to Boise once a month, and then once every other month, and then every 6 months, and then once a year, and he'd say, "Hi, Fred, how's everything? Fine. Bye, Fred. See you next time." See? So even though I was within the Worldwide Church of God, I was not highly connected to the hierarchy in as much as that I was virtually operating on my own. But I was not in rebellion to the authority that was in the church, nor did I put down Pasadena. I always upheld Pasadena. Okay? But I was not the fanatic that I would mention Herbert Armstrong's name as I scored in one sermon 110 times by Dave Albert in Pasadena years later. 110 times in one sermon. So anyway, we moved down to Salt Lake, and I decided to do a series in Galatians. And I still have the paper, by the way. And we were told that if you write up anything, or if you find any new truth, quote-untruth, write it up and send it in. So I began to, here, let's go to Galatians 3. Galatians 3, because there's a glaring contradiction here if you read it. And in talking to the Church of God Seventh-day ministers, I began to understand that Herbert Armstrong was preaching Galatians 3 according to the Church of God Seventh-day understanding, which is basically this. Let's come to verse 19, Galatians 3. "Wherefore then serves the law," meaning the law of sacrifices. This is the way it was understood. "It was added because of transgressions, because when Moses was on the mountain, the children of Israel sinned, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made," and so forth. Well, that's not the correct meaning, because you have a contradiction here. Let's go back to verse 14. "That the blessing of Abraham might come on the Gentiles through Jesus Christ, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. And brethren, I speak after the manner of men. Though it be but a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannuls or adds to." Well, how can you have, verse 19, "it was added" when it says you can't add to? See, there's a distinct contradiction within three verses. So I read on. "Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He said not, and to seeds of many, but as of one, and to your seed, which is Christ. And this I say, that the covenant which was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law which was given to Israel," meaning the whole old covenant, "which was 430 years afterward, cannot disannul that it should make the promise of no effect." So we're talking about the promise. We're not talking about law upon law. We are talking about promise and covenant. "For if inheritance be of the law, that is through the old covenant, it is no more a promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. Wherefore then serves the law, meaning the whole old covenant, not just the law of sacrifices. It was placed alongside the promises because you can't add to it, but you can place it alongside for the purpose of showing what transgression is till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And so I wrote that up and I sent it in to Pasadena, and guess whose hands it goes through? And I did a very bad thing. I rented a bulletin typewriter, has typed this big, so that Herbert Armstrong could read it, because remember his eyes, he had the blood clot behind his eye. Went to the hands of Roderick Meredith and Al Caruso. And I didn't know it, but their thought was, see, not interested in truth. Now, if I would have brought it to Herbert Armstrong personally, I am sure he would have embraced it. I am sure he would have taught it. See? But they looked at it. Who is this upstart to correct Herbert Armstrong? God's apostle. That's right. And I didn't know this. So here I am marked and targeted. So, sometime later, let me just mention that we had a woman that was dying of breast cancer, and my woman saw her breast, and it was black as coal, and she was on her deathbed. And so we had the church in Boise and Salt Lake fast, and I came back from Boise on Sunday. I remember we took Morgan Tovey, who was a deacon with me, and I went up to anoint her. I remember walking in the house, and you could smell death. I walked in, and here she is in pain and misery and agony and just, you know, skin and bones. And at that point, you know, I knew either God had to heal her or she had to die. And so that was my prayer. I just kneeled down and anointed her and said, God, you know, if it is your will to heal her, please do. If not, let her die quickly and end the suffering. And got up. She started to improve right away. And she also, with the help of the women, did a lot of things with herbs to purge the cancer out of her system. And in 10 days, she was up walking about and healed. And she was completely healed and restored to health. So, Rod Meredith down in Pasadena schedules a visit to come out and see this rebellious Fred, who would dare write something against Herbert Armstrong. Well, I didn't write it against him. I'm just following their instructions that if there's something new, you write it up and send it in. Okay. So he calls up. This is just a regular field visit, Fred. Oh, that's fine. Yes. Of course, I didn't know what he had in mind, see, till just before the end of his visit. So I said, well, how would you like us to have spokesman's club and a dinner dance and Salt Lake and then Bible study and then Sabbath services, and then go on up to Boise, and then you can preach there, and then we'll have spokesman's club afterwards with a dinner dance and so forth. Says, yeah, that'll be fine. So got it all set up. He came out, and we had the dinner dance, and he got done with his evaluation. After hearing all the men speak, you know, table topics and all the speeches and everything, and he got up and he said, and I know this galled him, but he said, at least he was honest in it, this is the best spokesman's club I have ever seen, regardless of where I've gone in the whole United States. Said the questions were the most intelligent with the best answers I have ever heard. See. And then we get out there and we're dancing, and he comes up to me and says, well, where's this Mrs. Beam who was healed of cancer? So I showed him where she was, dancing with her husband. So he goes over there. You know how Rod does. He cocks his head like this, and he's over there talking with her. And I guess he really didn't believe that she had cancer and that she was completely healed. See? So how can Fred be so bad if all of this is coming out this way, see? You know. So he was stymied because he was expecting to find a rebellious congregation, you know, and all this sort of thing. Went up to Boise and the same thing. He was flabbergasted. So Sunday morning, after we come back to Salt Lake City, he has his overall evaluation for me and Dolores. And that's when I understood the purpose of his visit. we sit down, and, you know, he has his stern look, and he says, "Do you believe that Herbert Armstrong is God's apostle?" Well, I suppose with the paper, he didn't think that I did. Because how dare you correct him, see? Well, I didn't think I was correcting him. I thought I was bringing, you know, no truth. He didn't say that, but this was kind of the thought in mind. I said, "Well, of course I do." He says, "Well, this paper you wrote, the only thing he could find wrong with it was," he said, "and you should have never rented that bulletin typewriter and used church funds to do it, $125. That's the only thing he could get me on, see?" Okay.